deserving listeners, I don't know if you remember, a while back we did an episode on Scientology, and we had a special guest on the show to talk about Scientology, John Attack. Is that how I pronounce it, John?
I'm a bit more peaceful than that. I say ATAC.
ATAC. So no. More like a tack, like a thumbtack,
yeah.
Kind of a thing.
Possibly, yes.
Yeah.
Not in physical appearance, hopefully. But.
And I was blown away by how much John knew about Scientology, how much he knew about cults, how he did a lot of investigative journalism, how for decades, and he's written books, and he's a super expert on it. And I just had no idea what a wealth of knowledge John would have. And when I published the episode, I got a lot of positive response from people saying, like, oh my God, you got to have that guy back on the show. So here we are with John back on the show. Welcome back to the show, John.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was such a pleasure last time.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor here in Seattle. John, we are talking over Skype, and you are very far away. Where are you right now?
I'm just outside Nottingham in the heart of England.
Awesome. So what, you know, let's just open-ended question here, John. What other awesome stuff can you tell us about? And if you want to start with a plug for your organization, that might be good.
Surely, yes. I'm the director of projects at the Open Minds Foundation, which is an international charity. And our concern is to help people to help others who've been manipulated, whether it's by cult groups or, terrorist groups, gangs, in domestic abuse situations, because we see that there are common elements in all of these things. In fact, while I did speak with you last year about Scientology, I haven't seriously worked on that subject for over 20 years. It's just that people keep wanting to talk to me about it. So my attention has been on the much wider remit of the way that we give in to human predators, the way that we allow human predators, into positions of power in our society. We vote them in. And the way that our society has been devastated, human society, from the beginnings, from Sumeria onwards, has always had these terrible people. And understanding their personalities, how we can avoid being manipulated, how we can help those people so that they are put in situations where they can't manipulate us, and how we can understand the sometimes very subtle tricks that they use. My journey into Scientology is, and I left Scientology 34 years ago now, but I was 19 when I got involved. And there were two questions that really fascinated me and had done from the beginning of my teens. The first was, how could the German people, German-speaking people, have voted to get rid of democracy? That 98% of German speakers in 1938, after the Anschluss, the union with Austria, voted to not have voting rights anymore. How could they have backed this terrible regime? And the other question was at the other end of the scale, which is as a kid, I read about Jack the Ripper, this horrific murderer who used to maim his victims. How could anybody do that kind of thing? Excuse me. And I suppose my life's journey from then on has been, trying to understand those questions and see if there are things that we can do to help the victims of predation, but also, to wise us all up about, how it's going on and, how we can help other people not to be taken in.
Yeah, so you've dedicated your career to writing, speaking, and also helping actual victims of this as a counselor, correct?
Yeah, I don't really use the word counselor. I talk with people. I've probably helped, I reckon, about 600 people who've come out of, high control groups by talking with them. And, I'm aware of methods of counseling and approaches to counseling. But for me, it's largely a matter of you know, listening actively to what they have to say, making sure I understand what they have to say. And as you know, often that's enough for people, that the idea that somebody cares enough to hear them out and allow them to speak up, it often is a very therapeutic process. But the other part is putting them towards information that would be useful. So when I was dealing with Scientologists, it would be, you know, understanding the creator of Scientology and his bizarre pathology, and the many contradictions in his teachings. And it would be the same, you know, if I was talking with somebody who'd come out of the Krishna consciousness movement or a Rajneeshi or what have you. I moved away from, you know, more direct contact about 20 years ago because I wanted to understand the psychology. I also started writing novels at that time in the attempt to, because I think that popular culture is where, you know, change happens in society. But sadly, I didn't manage to write a massive selling novel. My book about Scientology, Let's Sell These People a Piece of Blue Sky, was a bestseller. But my novels are perhaps, publishers will come back to me and say, oh, you write really well, but I don't think people are ready for what you're saying or whatever, you know, so maybe one day.
You also train counselors, correct, on how to help people who are recovering from a cult or I can't remember the phrase you use, high control relationship.
Yes. At Open Minds, we have a number of counselors. Have Rachel Bernstein in Los Angeles, who's quite something. My dear friend Christian Cherko here in Oxford. Jilly Jenkinson, who's just got a PhD and runs a retreat for former cult members. Steve Hassan in Boston, or near Boston, in fact. All of us looking at different approaches to helping people who've been through this. And I must say that many counseling approaches are really not helpful to people who've been through these sort of authoritarian relationships, because sometimes the counselor doesn't realize that they're taking on the role of the authority figure rather than pursuing, you know, helping the person to pursue their own autonomy. So you do have to be very careful in how you deal with people. But we have material on recovery and some recommendations at openmindsfoundation.org. I'm working with a counselor in Holland called Francis Peters, who was herself grew up in the Jehovah's Witness organization, which is a very, very strange organization indeed, and huge. They have 7 or 8 million members around the world, you know, much bigger than Scientology, which in fact has about 25,000, you know, hardcore members. It's, you know, it pretends to be very much larger than it is.
Really? Only 25,000? That's surprising.
Yeah, I have published internal membership reports from the 1980s where they say, you know, we've got 25,000 members internationally. And they realized they'd made a mistake because at that time they were claiming to the press that they had 11 million members.
Yeah, there's a lot of I've known a lot of Jehovah's Witness people and had them as clients before. And don't think I've ever had a Scientology client. So I guess that's representative of that statistic.
Also, of course, Scientologists are they have a terrible phobia of any word that begins with psych.
Yeah, exactly.
It is very rare for them to seek any kind of help at all, which was a part of the conundrum for me. As you know, how was I going to reach these people? Because I think anybody who is in a manipulative situation, if you say to, or almost anybody, if you say to them, "Are you being manipulated?" they'll say no, and that's the end of the conversation.
Yeah, I wanted to, because I'm guessing some of the listeners are wondering about how the pitfalls of counselors as they typically will work with people who are recovering or who are transitioning, shall we say, away from a high control organization or relationship. And you had found, if I remember right, and correct me if I'm wrong, that counselors will essentially go too fast and they'll tell the client that, you know, like the client will come and they'll still have half a brain in that cult world or that, you know, in that sort of strange way of thinking world. And the counselor will say, like, you need to stop thinking that way, and because that's all wrong, and you don't understand, and, you know, let's look at the data, let's look at reality, and it's too fast, and it ends up either pushing people away, or it ends up, like you said, just becoming another controlling relationship where the therapist is being dominant over the client and indoctrinating them, so to speak, into another controlled relational thinking environment, rather than allowing the client to take their time and discover things for themselves and gain control over their own mind. Am I describing this correctly?
Yes, absolutely correctly. I think there's a fundamental problem in that clinical psychologists, counselors, are often only trained in individual psychology. And to understand somebody who's been through a group process, you need to understand the group psychology. You need to you need to look at the work of Zimbardo, for example, or Milgram or Ash, and look at how people relate in groups. And you have to get through that outer layer first. And there are all sorts of commonplaces that you will find between high-control groups. I very much like Janja Lelich and Madeline Tobias's book, Take Back Your Life, which gives a really powerful set of tools for dealing with undoing cult manipulations. But I think I've had situations where people have come to me and said that they've gone to a counselor and said, well, look, I think you should read something about Scientology or Rajneesh or what have you. And the counselor has said, I don't need to. And the arrogance, in that notion is really quite dangerous, that you have to have an empathy for the person's experiences. So, it's almost like, going to a counselor, being told to, pull yourself together and stop being. The other end of it, you get the application of techniques. I'm hesitant. I do work with people who use hypnotherapy and eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And I am very wary of any approach that tries to put aside conscious reasoning on the part of the person. Now, again, with ex-cult members, in general, they've been subjected to hypnotic procedures in one form or another. And their consent has been overridden. So, the EMDR as an approach, which is now moving into the counter-cult field, I have great hesitation over it. How successful it is with post-traumatic stress disorder is another matter. And I would like to see some longitudinal follow-ups on that.
Really? Tell me more about that. You're saying that EMDR is being adopted or moving into the counter-cult culture. Tell me more about that.
Well, International Cultic Studies Association, ICSA, based in the US, they have a text coming out which will have a chapter recommending EMDR for former cult members. I'm very hesitant because for me, there is only one goal in any form of therapy, and that is to get the person to become a sovereign self, to have autonomy, to be able to think for themselves. And it's too easy to believe that you've achieved that when actually what you've done is become a guru and they're now mouthing, your thoughts. And I'm sure we all know the perils of transference and indeed counter-transference, where, the client falls in love with you or falls in hate with you, and the same thing can happen the other way. I think it is very important to understand attachment. I think Bowlby's work and the work that's come since, looking at how we attach and saying, well, maybe the problem is in part one of maturity. I came from a very secure family compared to most, loving, secure, supportive family. And it surprised me to realize, I was reading a friend of mine, Alex Stain, who's a social psychologist. She published a wonderful book last year called Terror, Love, and Brainwashing. And she describes her own experiences in a socialist cult, I think in Minnesota, very small, very controlling group. And she describes disorganized attachment, so that rather than having you know, a secure attachment or a dismissive attachment where somebody's just pushing you away, or an avoidant attachment, the three classic forms, you have a disorganized attachment. So the person that you've, you know, is meant to be your source of comfort and security is the person who's attacking you. And she quite rightly points out that this is what happens to many in abusive relationships, that, you know, the cult leader is the person who's saying, oh, come here, I love you, and then slapping them, you know, that there's that conflict. And it becomes almost an infant attachment to a parent, that, you know, they become dependent. Now, I was surprised in reading this, and I have tremendous respect for Alex's work, that from her description, I'd never been a cult member. You know, I'd never had a disorganized attachment. I'd never been traumatized or humiliated or abused as a member of Scientology, but that's because I was never a live-in member. I was never on the staff, as they put it. I paid for to have my head messed up by them. So I was treated with a certain degree of courtesy. You know, I was shouted at twice and shouted back on both occasions, not realizing I wasn't meant to. But what happens is that one's attachment goes wrong. And the problem is, if you have a disorganized attachment and you then go to a therapist, a counselor, trying to resolve that, it's very easy to fall into a similar relationship with a counselor. And I think you have to first of all peel off what I call the cultic shell, which is a set of responses. I mean, I had a case many years ago. A young man had been found on the side of the highway by the police on the we call it the hard shoulder. I'm not sure what you call it there, actually, that, you know, that runs alongside a highway that you can pull off onto with the car. What's the word for that in America?
Shoulder, yeah.
Yeah, the shoulder. And the police had found this guy, and he was having a conversation with a 2-billion-year-old parrot who was sitting on his shoulder. That's what he told me later. He was taken to a psychiatric hospital. All sorts of things happened to him, and psychiatrist there said, oh, look, there's this, he was a Scientologist, send him to this John Atack bloke. And it was remarkable. He'd had 6 weeks of in a psychiatric hospital, and I just sat and listened to him, and I could predict, I could say, you know, I knew why he was thinking what he was thinking, I knew where it had gone, and he'd suffered an acute psychosis. The same year, I gave a talk at a mental hospital, which is close to Scientology's facility at St. Hill in the south of England. And every year, they'd get a few Scientologists. And I sat down and 14 staff attended. I was really amazed because I know that people in psychiatric hospitals work ridiculous hours. So the thought they were going to use their spare time to come and listen to me was, you know, it was really impressive. And at the end of it, one of them came up, or a couple of them came up and said, you know, how are you able to describe exactly how these people behave when they come here? And that's the understanding of what had happened to them. You know, they'd been told that they were infested with lots of little spirits and, you know, didn't have control over their own minds. And you can pretty much predict the behavior of somebody according to their belief system. So you know how they'll view the world. And in that way, you can fairly quickly bring them back to earth. If you don't understand that and you just try and apply, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy or, you know, EMDR or whatever else, then things can go badly amiss.
Yeah, and you're describing it really well, and it's broadly applicable to the counseling and psychotherapy profession in general, in that there's a seduction from that happens to a therapist in a situation where you have a client who in some ways is kind of an empty vessel due to their attachment issues and being abused as children. There's a seduction to that the client actually does unconsciously to the therapist to step in as a controller, as someone who can tell them what to do, who can protect them, and the client will feel safe, but also quite resentful of the fact that they're not allowed to be independent. And it's up to therapists to notice that seduction and notice their own narcissistic urges to become that you know, benevolent controller over someone's life. And there's a fair enough common therapeutic countertransference issue that it's talked about quite frequently. But I have to say that it, just anecdotally, I know of many therapists, including myself, I guess, at times, who fail that test. And you know, it's a very easy thing to think as a therapist, like, well, this person is you know, really dysfunctional, and they're really asking for my help, and they're really nice, and you know what? I have good advice. You know, I have good things to say, and I think that their boyfriend is a jerk, and I think that she would be better off without him, and I think that they need to separate from their family of origin. Their parents are really quite, you know, abusive in their ways, and maybe their boss is kind of a jerk, and they should quit their job. You know, and this is all sounding like we're in Waco and I'm David Koresh, you know, like slowly isolating this person and trying to get them, you know, under my wing, because my wing is best. You know, it's a very common mistake that therapists will fall into.
And it's perfectly natural. And I think we all have to admit that. And I think that any therapist or anybody who's trying to help people who doesn't admit that it's nice to be adulated. It's nice to, you know, have somebody think that you're really special and all of that. I very early on, because as I say, I don't view myself as a counselor. I mean, you know, I'm somebody there to facilitate another person's understanding of information. You know, so it's more that I'm showing them something about the group they belong to. And showing them how to, I mean, I call it, for me, it's a chain reaction thing. If I'm dealing with it with an ex-member, I started in 2013, I started writing at Tony Ortega's Underground Bunker. Tony is this incredible journalist. He used to be the editor of The Village Voice. And he just decided, not for any financial reason or for any health reason, that Scientology was just too fascinating. There were stories, and could he find a story every day? And for the last, you know, 5 or 6 years, he's found a story every day about Scientology, on top of working a real job and doing things. I started blogging there because I left the scene in 1996 because I'd been harassed into the ground by Scientology for a period of 12 years. And I was tired out, and nobody was there to defend or protect me. And so I moved away. But in 2013, a journalist called Steve Kinnane, who was with ABC in Australia and has since written a wonderful history of Scientology in Australia called Fair Game, which has got some hilarious things in it and some really sinister things in it too. But he came to talk to me in 2012, and he said he knew this young woman who had been sexually abused from the age of 6 to the age of 11 by her Scientology stepfather and Scientology's stepfather. She'd gone to the police and been persuaded by the head of Scientology's, get this, Citizens Commission on Human Rights, to withdraw the complaint, sent back into the house where this guy was physically abusive to her for another 5 years, joined Scientology's horrible SEA organization, where you kind of work a 90-hour week as a slave for $5 a week, had 5 years of doing that, and then left. And Steve said to me, well, you know, will you talk to this woman? And I was sort of, well, I don't really do that anymore. But, you know, I couldn't help it. And I talked to her, and I'd sort of thought, well, you know, she was 6, she was 11, then 16 when she joined the series. So she left when she was 21. So, you know, I'm going to be talking. Oh, and she then went and got a degree in medical science. I'll be talking to somebody who's in her 20s. Well, no, she was 37 years old. And for 16 years, she grew up in it. It was all she knew. Very intelligent, got a degree, actually got onto a master's program, and then found she couldn't cope with that. And here she was at age 37 saying to me, you know, Ron Hubbard says that reality is an agreement, you know, that, that all the spirits in the universe agree that the universe is this way and that's why it is. So is reality an agreement? And I said to her, well, it is if you're a hypnotist, because what you're doing is getting everybody to agree with what you say. But in the real world, no, it's out there, whether you agree it's out there or not. And the next week she came back to me and she said, I've used scented laundry conditioner. And we both knew what she meant. We haven't talked about this at all, but when you join the sea organization, and that's C-S-E-A as in a body of water, you read something called the hygiene hat. And it tells you that you mustn't use anything scented because, get this is very important to understand this, the psychiatrists and the other psychs like yourself, I'm afraid, Kirk, are controlling the universe in a conspiracy using scent. And so perfumes are absolutely forbidden. So we both knew that without us talking about it at all, she'd broken one of the taboos, she'd broken a rule. And, you know, for me, that's the basic process that has to happen first, that you get the member to be willing to challenge the dogma. You don't challenge it for them. You don't take it apart for them. You might do a little bit to show them. But when they start going, oh, heck, they made me work 17 hours a day, you know, now I come to think about it. I mean, she talked about only having one uniform. And so they'd get in at 2 a.m, they'd have to wash their, you know, shirts and their tights and what have you, and then iron them half dry before they went to bed to get up at 6 a.m. and put them on again. And it's when the person says, actually, that was abusive. Actually, so it's not somebody from the outside explaining anything to them. It's, and a chain reaction then begins where they start to look at the situation. After talking with her, I came back and I started writing about Scientology and recovery from Scientology, because I realized that the majority of people who come out of that organization never recover. They never regain their self-determination, their, you know, autonomy. They will be, I mean, I remember talking to Cyril Vosper, who was a 14-year member. He wrote a best-selling book called The Mindbenders, which was published in 1968, and lovely guy. The first time I met him, he said, you know, it was by then, in fact, 14 years since he'd left. And he said, but he still found himself walking down the street and saying, oh, did I commit an overt, you know, a sinful or criminal act? He still found the words were in his head. He still found it was going on. And you have to help somebody through that before you can address them in counseling. And it'll take, you know, however long it takes. With some people, it's an afternoon. You know, they get it. With other people, it takes them years of fighting where they'll still be, you know, being independent Scientologists and believing that, you know, they can achieve supernatural powers by following this route that they've been following for however long.
Yeah, it's just amazing work that you've been doing. And I think that it's generalizable to all of therapy and all of clients in terms of really trying to understand where the client is and where they come from and the system that they exist in, and not assuming that a simple statement or a, you know, cognitive automatic thought restructuring process will just simply change that around. Mm-hmm. And I guess to me, the thing that whenever I run into this with supervisees and trainees, and not necessarily with cults, but just with high control relationships. Often it's intimate partner violence, and, you know, within marriages and couples. And the first thing I always ask my trainees is, I say, have you ever been in a relationship where you felt controlled and afraid to think independently? And there's a big difference between those who say, yeah, I have been, and those who would say, no, I never have been. It's such a weird phenomenon. It's such a weird place to be. And until you either really understand other people's experience or, unfortunately, go through it yourself, you really just don't understand the malleability of your personality and your belief system and your reality, and how in some ways it makes me wonder, well, I'm not outside of that, so how have I been shaped by my society? You know, that's always what I'm trying to think, you know. What political views do I have? What kind of ideas about medicine or even psychotherapy do I have? Because I've been, because it's so around me, you know. I'm in the huge cult called Seattle Liberals, you know, and so it's disconcerting to think that your thoughts aren't really yours and that you might be outside of quote unquote reality, and so. It's a very strange conversation that I feel like when I'm talking with my students, they glaze over with boredom because they're just like, huh? But I want to take a break. And when we get back, you mentioned about voting people in to control. And as an American, I have a couple questions for you. So can we take a break, John?
Yes, absolutely, Kirk.
All right, we're back from the break. If you haven't become a patron of the podcast, do so now. Go to patreon.com. That's patreon.com. When you become a patron, you don't have to listen to commercials, and you also get access to all of our premium episodes. So, John, I'm guessing you've been asked about this past year.
I think I can sense what's coming here.
What do you have to say about it? Anything? What I'm scared to ask in some way.
Let me reflect first on what you've just said, because I think you've said something that's vitally important, and that is that wherever you look, somebody or other is going to come up with this idea. You know, I'm an agnostic, but I refer a great deal to religious teaching. You know, unlike the kind of militant atheists, I see that there's a tremendous amount of wisdom to be had there. And one of the things that Jesus allegedly said is that we should watch out for the plank in our own eyes rather than the little bit of sawdust that we can see in somebody else's. And I think that that is should be a daily reflection that we are, you know, we're within our culture, whether that's a Seattle liberal or an English liberal. And we tend to look at that which is strange to us. I mean, I remember reading, I was a teenager and read a book called The Silence by Shusaku Endo. And Endo was a Japanese Christian. It's a remarkable novel written about the persecution of Japanese Christians in the 17th century. And what struck me about this book was that Endo took certain things as normal and for granted culturally that were horrifying to me. As somebody who'd grown up not in the Japanese culture, where this was kind of a normal way of looking at things. If we then transfer that into our conversation now, what happened in America is that the division between the Democrats and the Republicans, and, you know, I am going to admit to having friends in both camps here, has become so heated, and politics has become such a filthy business. I mean, I'm not sure that it's ever been anything but. I think occasionally there are really genuine people who become politicians and who do it for the right reasons. But very much as with the councillor, it's one thing to have one person sit down and adulate you because you're the authority figure now. But when you have a whole nation sitting down and adulating you, your testosterone levels have to go through the roof. So I think the kind of combative political system, the two-party system, is inevitably going to lead to conflict and also rouse ancient conflicts. Of course, you know, the discussion about the American Civil War, that this is still, you know, 150 years later, this is still a hot topic for many people in the United States. And so, you know, people who side with the Confederacy will say, well, it was never about slavery, of course. And, you know, it was about, you know, the right of independence from a federation or what have you. These arguments are still turning over, the racial arguments, the, you know, the land grab of Texas and New Mexico, Arizona, California in 1847 being bought from the Spanish, the Mexican people.
Well, quote unquote, bought, you know, under duress.
Yes, absolutely. There was a certain degree of pressure, but remembering the Alamo, there was only pressure. And this notion that, I mean, a dear friend was telling me the other day that he was a patriot. And I said, oh, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, I think the Bill of Rights is the most brilliant document ever written. And I said, well, that's good. Let's go and look at what the dictionary says a patriot is. And it's somebody who's willing to fight for the ideal of their country. You know, it's not somebody who believes that their country has certain values. And that then takes us off into, what do we mean by country? You know, nations were something that was invented by the ruling classes to bring this kind of adulation, so that, you know, into the 19th century, people had to go and fight wars because otherwise they'd be shot for, you know, not doing what the bosses said. And then Garibaldi and the Prussians and various people brought about this notion of a nation. And it, I suppose it does come with the founding fathers as well, when the United States was actually a very small strip down the right-hand side of the country, you know. What do we mean by that? You know, I love my nation. Does it mean I love all the people in my nation? Does it mean I love the white people or the dark-skinned people or the red-skinned people or whatever skin color? Does it mean I love the men but not the women? What are our rights? What do we mean by this affection, which is completely abstract? It seems to me that what happened in the US election, which I think is what we're talking about, that, you know, Donald Trump played a remarkably good hand. He did all the right things to get people to follow him, you know, against the will of the Republican Party, which is quite interesting. Do you know Frank Luntz's book, Words That Work? Luntz wrote many of the famous declarations of the Republican Party, and, you know, he's a manipulator, he's a spin doctor. But John Kerry said of his book, I have it in front of me, Frank Luntz understands the power of words to move public opinion and communicate big ideas. Any Democrat who writes off his analysis and decades of experience just because he works for the other side is making a big mistake. His lessons don't have a party label. The only question is, where's our Frank Luntz? Now, I believe that if Hillary Clinton had taken John Kerry's advice, things would have been quite different.
What would that have looked like? Her using short phrases that everyone understands? And
he becomes very specific about what you can and can't say. Let me open the book up and see if I can find a ready example of that. Towards the end of the book, he just never say wiretapping or eavesdropping. Always say electronic intercepts.
Ah.
Never say deny, say not give. And he talks somewhere in here, yeah, healthcare, never say healthcare choice, say the right to choose. And he also talks about immigrants somewhere here and immigration. Yes, never say undocumented workers or aliens, always say illegal immigrants and border security. I feel that if the Democrats had understood this a little better, they would have, you know, possibly, you know, done rather better. Having said that, of course, we're told that Hillary Clinton received 3 million more votes than Donald Trump, and it's because of this antiquated system of, you know, the electoral colleges. So, you know, that's asked large questions about democracy. I think what we are seeing is a divided society. And it's a tragedy that whatever his virtues, Barack Obama was not able to overcome that in 8 years. He was not able to bring a unifying force. Donald Trump told people what they wanted to hear. Whether he can do it or not, it is another matter. I would guess, and I'm not a political pundit, but I would guess that when the midterms come, that there's going to be a Democrat House and a Democrat Senate. And so we're going to have the gridlock that, you know, one president after another has had to deal with.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I blame you for the Electoral College thing, John, because most of our founding fathers, if not all of them, were English by descent. And so I blame you for that system, by the way.
I think you're absolutely right to do that. I take full responsibility.
And, yeah, I mean, when I look back on 2016, and the election, everyone, including Trump himself, didn't think Trump was going to win with that strategy. And so it's all sort of 2020 and looking back and going like, wait, so all that worked? Because at the time it was like, well, surely speaking rationally and not using funny tweets, you know, or weird tweets, that surely that's just shooting him in the foot, you know. And so I think looking back to Kerry's advice, if 2016, I would have said to Hillary Clinton, I would have said, stay the course, act like a normal human being, and, you know, don't give in to that doublespeak from 1984. So I want to ask you some questions, because I recently did an episode on Charles Manson.
Yep.
And I did a mini deep dive into his life, and I really just didn't have knowledge about all the ins and outs. I mean, it's a pretty weird story involving the Beach Boys and just all these different things. And I was wondering what you thought about Charles Manson's technique in getting people to join his small little cult.
Well, Manson actually, a guy called Noel Emmons wrote a book called Without Conscience, not to be confused with Robert Hare, the psychologist's book, Without Conscience, with the participation of Charles Manson. And it's a fascinating book because Manson basically was in the system from the age of 12. In the next 20 years, he spent more years in the system than on the outside. And he said that he was a terrified kid. He was small. He was not physically powerful. He was easily intimidated. And then when he was in prison, he started to receive Scientology auditing. And in fact, he claimed, I believe, that he had 150 hours of Dianetic and Scientology therapy. And he said, this made me, confident and willing to, assert myself. As you say, he was with the Beach Boys, though I think Brian Wilson was gone by that time and sitting in the sandpit with his in-house psychiatric guru who almost ruined his life completely. And so the Beach Boys were looking for new material. I believe they actually recorded two Charles Manson songs.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, I'm giving off bad vibrations or something like that. Very bad vibrations. And I think what he acquired was the skill that Hubbard himself acquired, which is this realization that it is very easy to manipulate people. It's very easy to control people's attention and divert them from their own best interests. Two of his followers in the family had also done Scientology. If we're going to get any further, David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, had also been involved with the Scientology offshoot. And I think if you teach somebody control techniques, and, Scientology is, they're not kidding. They use hard sell techniques, and they boast about it. I wrote a little book called Scientology, The Cult of Greed, which was, 100-page primer for anybody who'd never been, had no experience of it. The piece of blue sky was written primarily to help people who'd been through the experience. But in looking at the hard selling techniques, Hubbard makes no bones about it. He's quite open. This is, most people are in a hypnotic daze anyway. So let's control them. Let's get them to hand over their money. Let's get them to borrow huge amounts of money and give it to us. And I think Manson clicked into that thing that for many manipulative people, they realize that you just keep lying and you can get away with it. So I think his involvement with Scientology was pivotal. I think it was very important. We then come to the other end of the question, which is this bizarre thing that he was sent to prison really for conspiracy to commit murder, because he wasn't there and he wasn't active in any of the murders. And there's this problem of, if his followers were brainwashed, you know, which was pretty much accepted with Patty Hearst, that you know, she was released because her mind had been taken over, why wasn't the same true for Manson's followers? You know, who was actually in charge?
Well, what do you think? Do you think, given your knowledge, do you think they should have been, especially if I remember right, the three young women, do you think they should have been off the hook?
I don't. I'd probably take a different view to most. I'd certainly take a different view to the law as it exists at the moment, because the idea of responsibility, which in we talk of mens rea and actus reus, the intention to commit the act and the commission of the act. If you didn't have the intention to commit the act, then you haven't committed a crime. So if you're a lunatic, then you're not a criminal, you're a criminal lunatic. And I think practically we had Peter Sutcliffe, who is called the Yorkshire Ripper here, who I think killed seven women with a hammer. And he's recently, I think last year, the year before, they've decided he's no longer mad, which is a really interesting idea. But the judge who sentenced him, if I remember properly, said, I don't care if he's mad, he should never be let out again. And I think there's a balance that even if you are that control by somebody is never 100% excuse, it's never justifiable. We have to be held accountable for our actions. But I think there was strong mitigation to look at the sentencing, that those people, for the horror of the crimes they committed, deserved, you know, to be taken out of society. But I think then that there's a point where you have to assess them after a certain period of time and say, you know, are they socially fit again? Are they able to interact with people?
Right. My sense. Yeah. The question is, like, would they have been susceptible to this kind of crime without the charismatic controller brainwasher person, that person, are they still susceptible? And it brings in all the questions about, like, is our criminal justice system and prison supposed to be for rehabilitation, or is it for revenge or punishment, and, you know, disincentivizing other people in the future committing these crimes? And, you know, brings all that into the conversation.
Yes, and all of those questions have to be addressed. But the United States is, I believe, now the only Western nation that has the death penalty.
Right, because most Americans anecdotally believe that prison is not for rehabilitation, it's for punishment and to discourage future criminals. And so they wouldn't say that per se, but that's, I think, how they feel about it.
I think so. I think so, and I think that's a fundamental feeling that we have as human beings, that people deserve, if they've committed atrocities, they deserve to be treated atrociously. And the problem comes when you look at evidence. There's a documentary made 20 years ago about what was called a reform school in England. The place was called Pepper Harrow. And a documentary had been made about it in 1973, and then 20 years later they came back, and there'd been six kids who were in the original film. It was a Borstal or reform school, a place for juvenile offenders. One of them had died since the first documentary. One of them refused to be filmed, but the other four were all filmed. And there were remarkable things said. We, in Britain in 1980... a politician called William Whitelaw, working in Margaret Thatcher's government, brought in a policy called the short, sharp shock. which of itself is a despicable reference because it's a reference to the Mikado by Gilbert and Sullivan, and it means execution, in fact, a short, sharp shock. So he knew what he was talking about and what he was quoting, but it's this idea of boot camp. It's this idea of we'll beat people into becoming better people. The recidivism rate within 2 years is 80% in this program. The recidivism rate at Pepper Harrow was 10%. And they would, you know, I was a bit shocked. They were a bunch of hippies, basically. You know, I remember there's a shot of an 8-year-old boy walking around smoking a cigarette, and nobody tells him off. But there was a 14-year-old there, and he was there for theft, petty theft. And his explanation was that he had three younger siblings, that his mother, you know, wasn't mentally competent to look after them. And so he had to go and find food. And so he stole food. Now, he'd never been to school. He was 14. He couldn't read and write. 20 years later, he has got a master's degree, and he is a senior man in the child reform system. You know, for the county that he I think was the head of the county. And that speaks to the idea that you can reform people. The problem is, how many of them can you reform? I'm trying to remember whether it was Wisconsin or Wyoming, but there was a project with hundreds of juveniles where they took kids who were diagnosed with the callous and unemotional disorder, which automatically, when you're 18, makes you a psychopath. You're not allowed to call anybody who's under 18. And they separated the groups. I think it was Kent Keel who talked about this in one of his books. They separated the groups. There was a control group where they just did what they normally do. And then there was a group who received intensive therapy. And the point's always been made that if somebody has this condition, the sociopathic, psychopathic, antisocial disorder, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't cure it. But they showed, again with the recidivism rate, the control group in the next 2 years committed, after they'd been let out, committed 16 murders. The group that had received the therapy, there was no murder attributed to any of them. And so nurture becomes relevant.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea that just because you measure high on the psychopathic scale means you're doomed to future criminal acts is not supported by observation, even just of the general population. So yeah, and there are efforts. Like I did an episode a while back with a police officer here in Seattle who started what eventually became called the IF Project, IF Project, and she worked with women who had been in prison for a major crime, and she would have them write letters to teenagers who were at risk, who had also committed, you know, teenage versions of major crimes. And they would handwrite these letters while they were in prison. And, you know, these women are tough. They're not usually asked to talk about themselves, and they're not usually asked to talk about their feelings. And these women really stepped into the role, and they said, you know, I'm going to write a nurturing, revealing, emotional letter and to these younger women. And these younger women, these teenage girls, would read these letters and cry. And it was this huge deal. And it was all facilitated voluntarily through this police officer for the Seattle Police Department. And so there's these, and it, you know, anecdotally seemed to really, really help. And there are lots of things like that, but just not enough is the thing. When I was a kid, I actually had the opportunity to volunteer for this trip where we went to Montana, and there was a ranch with horses and 1,000 acres and big sky country, and we were there to help build a basketball court to, you know, like concrete and blah, blah, blah. and we hung out with these kids that were there. So a bunch of us kids went to this ranch, and there were kids living on the ranch. And we knew the kids living on the ranch were there because they were supposed to go to prison, but they chose to go to this ranch instead. And they were there. It was like prison, but it was a ranch, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were great kids, and we became friends with them, and they just seemed like they were taking a break from life, and they were rehabilitating, and they were learning, and, you know, we were talking about our feelings in circles and all that stuff. And then on the way out, when it was all said and done, our volunteer coordinator person, he told us the various crimes that these people had committed. And we were shocked because these people were not our stereotypical ideal of what a rapist looked like or a murderer looked like. And, you know, I always think back to that. I always think, like, I would imagine that those kids had a much better chance of getting back on their feet and living a happy life, one that didn't cause harm to other people, than kids who are locked up in some depressing brick institution, right?
Where they're being trained by their fellow inmates in crime, you know, yeah. And how to get away with it, how to, you know, the tricks and traps, and building their resentment. I mean, in any relationship, there are times when you have to use force. There are times where, you know, a child is going in front of an automobile and you have to pull them away. And, you know, shouting at them is not going to do it, and telling them off is not going to do it. You have to physically get in there and stop them. And if you have a serial killer, then it's a good idea to lock them up. You know, even if it's just, you know, for the sense of safety. I mean, here we had Myra Hindley, who, with her boyfriend Ian Brady, had captured, tortured, and murdered children. And she, for years, tried to be let out. And a friend of mine wrote a biography of Myra Hindley, and Myra Hindley sued her for libel. And the judge said, given what you've done, there's nothing anybody could say about you that would harm your reputation, and dismissed the case. But I believe that given what she had done, she deserved to be incarcerated, definitely. So I do think that, you know, there's a point where you don't want these people in society. They are dangerous. But what that point is, there's a neurologist, a neuroscientist called James Fallon, and he wrote a book called The Psychopath Inside. He was asked, he wanted to assess his family to see if anybody had a risk of Alzheimer's. So he's looking for plaques, plaque formation. And there were 9 other members of the family, and they all had a brain scan. And he had them randomized, so he didn't know who he was looking at. And he noticed that with one of them, that the absence of part of the paralimbic system, which is said to be a hallmark of psychopathy, was there. And so he said, well, who's this? And his assistant said, well, Jim, it's you. And he then found that he had 3 of the alleles that are commonly associated with psychopaths. And his mum told him that 7 of his ancestors, on his father's side, of course, had been murderers, including Lizzie Borden, apparently. So here he found himself, age 50-something, and he said he was running a couple of biotech companies. You know, he was doing good work in the world. He said that he'd always believed, right from childhood, that everything is genetic. And for the first time, his conviction was shaken. He realized that his mother had seen that there was something, you know, perhaps cruel about him, remorseless. And so she had treated him in a particular way. And he came up with the expression pro-social sociopath. So he talks about he went to Kenya, and he found out about the Marburg caves, where Marburg Ebola came from infected bats, it's thought. And he invited his brother over to go on safari there. So they went to the Marburg caves, and when his brother got home, he realized what Jim Fallon had done. So he will still risk other people. You know, he says, you know, if I'm going to a funeral and somebody asks me to a party, I'll go to the party. He'll find some mild-mannered, bespectacled professor colleague and get them really drunk and dancing naked on a table in a club. You know, he will push things, but there's a limit he will go to. And that brought him to say, well, yeah, even if you do have, if you're born with these tendencies, the environment in which you develop is everything. You know, which absolutely supports this view that by brutalizing people, you will make them worse. You won't make them better. You might force them, you know, when your eye is on them, they will do what you want them to do so they don't get hit. But as soon as your back is turned, they will stab you. So, you know, to be compassionate and to be concerned for other people's welfare and not to do this us and them thing. As you say, when you know, I too have met offenders. I had a friend who'd been a torturer. He worked within the British Army in the 1960s. And I'd known this guy for 7 or 8 years. And he was a very cheerful sort of guy who liked to go and have a drink and, you know, occasionally got into fights and things. One night he sat down and we were talking and he suddenly started crying and he talked about what he'd done to people. And he'd been a soldier. He'd killed 4 people in action. He had no problem with that because they would have killed him if he hadn't. But when he talked about torturing somebody, he broke down. And seeing that and going, well, if somebody can accept responsibility and feel remorse, then they're probably reasonably safe in society. And, you know, developing new approaches, because our prison system has failed totally, you know, particularly in the US where you have, you know, the highest per capita prison population of any country in the world. And I think they say 60% of them are in prison for things that weren't crimes in the year 1900, which is before the Harrison Act, I'm guessing, you know, so. There are so many people who are in there because they took drugs.
Or just had drugs on them.
Yeah, or had drugs on them. But even if they took drugs, we've now legalized homosexuality as a victimless crime. You know, that was how it was described in Britain when it was legalized in the 60s. It's a victimless crime. You know, who's the victim? And the same with a heroin addict or, you know, something like that. The victim is the person who's the criminal. And in Portugal, of course, in 2000, they decriminalized end use of all drugs. And they've had a massive decrease in crime. Well, they've had a significant decrease in crime, but they've also had a significant decrease in drug addiction. Because rather than being a kind of moral pariah, these people are now treated more in the way that alcoholics are treated. They're people who've lost their independence to, you know, something that gives them a dopamine rush and makes them, you know, chase after that thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the drug thing in America is so strange, and I feel it because I grew up in an environment where drugs were very rare. The first time I saw cocaine, I think I was, I don't know, in my 20s or something, and heroin even later than that. And so
I still haven't seen heroin, actually, though Scientology says I was a heroin addict.
Yeah, and so that's just one detail among many that influenced my understanding of these substances and the people that use them and why they use them and why someone would use it habitually and even though it's a problem for them. And really, even after I became a therapist in the mid-90s, I still had a lot of that in my mind. And very slowly over time, I've come to a very different understanding of that entire issue. And, and you know, I guess I could go into detail about that. But that's just to say that it's hard for... There's so many cultural messages that tell us that drug users are evil or weak or, you know, crime prone or they, you know, it's a choice they make, or they're just doing it because it feels good, and they could stop at any time if they just decided to. And these are low life deadbeats, blah, blah, blah. And it's just taken me forever to realize, even though I knew it statistically, I just had to talk with a lot of heroin addicts in particular to realize that heroin addicts are exactly like anyone else. You know, like in Seattle, we have Microsoft and Amazon and Starbucks, and heroin addicts work at Amazon. They work at Starbucks. They work at Microsoft, and they go to work like anyone else does. And sure, you know, you have your occasional homeless person who happens to be a heroin addict, I suppose. But it's a very common thing, and these people are struggling because it's so hard to kick the habit. And if our society just allowed them to come out into the light, we could actually help them, because there's actual ways to help them. It's not easy, but it's their ways. Instead of pushing them into the back alleys and shunning them and making them feel more ashamed than they already feel, by the way. So, John, I wanted to ask you one final question about Landmark. Do you know about Landmark Forum in here in the United States? I don't know if it's in Britain.
Earhart Seminar Training, as it used to be.
Yeah. I did a deep dive on this, and my co-host Umberto went to it to kind of check it out, and I've been to it a few times myself, just peripherally, and I just wanted to know what your opinion was of it, because to me it's sort of like Scientology light in some way, and I just wanted to know what your thoughts were on it.
Well, it's derivative of Scientology, firstly. Werner Earhart, what was his real name? I can't remember his real name. He was a car salesman, secondhand Jack Rosenberg or something. I was actually contacted by him in 1991, asking for my help to defend him from Scientology, because he reckoned they were coming after him. Then, before I didn't respond, and before I had a chance, the news broke that his children were seeking to sue him for sexual abuse. So he's an interesting character. Lionized as a great hero in American culture in the 70s. Then, you know, word started coming out about the breakdowns that people were having and the psychiatric treatment was necessary. And what he said he'd done was that he'd taken the Zen Buddhist notion of a moment of enlightenment, bursting the bag, as the Zen Buddhists call it, and Scientology. And he put the two things together into a large group awareness training, as we call it in the trade. For some people, you know, yes, you can push them really hard and they have some kind of experience that they feel is positive, and people must be allowed to decide for themselves what is or isn't positive. But the problem is that, you know, I remember when I first, you know, many years ago in the 80s, read a list of the aspects of a hypnotic state and went, my God, you know, that's what you feel at the end of a Scientology session. You know, the Scientologists talk about having very good indicators, which means grinning and being really happy. Well, that's the euphoria of a hypnoid state. You have some kind of realization that's meant to be a life-transforming realization. But when you talk to Scientology, it usually boils down to Ron was right about something. You know, Hubbard was right about something. So the same thing that with EST, Landmark Forum, or some of the other, LifeSpring, for example, there are many of these groups out there. Anything that induces an experience of fervor in a group of people should be looked at with tremendous care. I work very closely with one of my colleagues at Open Minds, is this brilliant guy called Yuval Laor, who I really think you ought to interview. He's a bit of a show-off. He got a double first in physics and philosophy. I mean, have you ever met anybody that did a double degree in a science and a humanity? I mean, that's just showing off. He then did a master's in history of science and ideas. And his dissertation tutor was Eva Yablonka, who is a really eminent evolutionary biologist. She's indeed one of the people who you know, showed that Richard Dawkins had got it wrong, that there is more than just the selfish gene going on in evolution. You know, Dawkins still doesn't accept epigenetics, poor man. But there are also cultural things that affect genes, and genes are, in fact, you know, they're not gradually changing. They're changing all the time. So he had this brilliant woman as his dissertation tutor. He then went, he did a PhD in cultural studies, focusing on awe and fervor. And he's done work, you know, I've had the great good fortune to work with him. We talk every week for the last couple of years on his ideas. And you see the way that you can take a group of people. We had a letter published in New Scientist last year, which we made Letter of the Week, which I thought was pretty good, because they'd done a serious article about awe, that it was now all right scientifically to consider this heightened emotion, which has been avoided because it's thought of as being religious in some way. And they were talking about the positive, you know, concomitant results of experiencing awe, bliss, ecstasy, whatever you want to call it. And we pointed out that while it is true that you know your physical health, your immune system, whatever, may improve with these feelings, this is also where the Nazis came from. This is also, you know, where genocide comes from in general. If you look at, you know, Rwanda or Cambodia, that you can take a group of people. And I think it's important to get that we have our own personal individual psychology. But as Gustave Le Bon, the first psychologist to study the crowd and wrote the book called The Crowd in the 1890s, he said that the intelligence of the crowd is the lowest common denominator, that the stupidest person in the crowd is the intellectual level of the crowd. Now, I'd say that you have individual psychology, group psychology, and swarm or mob psychology. And the problem with something like Landmark is that you're putting a group of people together. And I know that, you know, in neuro-linguistic programming, they were doing this kind of thing as well. And you are heightening emotion so that you get the adrenaline buzz, you get the opioid buzz on the back of that, you get dopamine pumping around, serotonin, all these good things. And people become foolish. Their intelligence, you know, subsides. One of the things that I knew a guy in Scientology, he had a first from Oxford University, and he said to me that when he came to sit his paper, he decided that the questions were stupid, so he just wrote down what he was thinking about. Now, you know, putting aside the hubris in that idea, he did get a first, and he was that clever, and yet he'd gone further into Scientology than I had. He was deeply involved. And so one minute he'd be talking perfect sense, and then the next minute he'd be talking perfect nonsense. And I think the group experiences where we become euphoric, we have a sense of awe, which develops into fervor, that we put aside our reasoning ability. And underneath this is a very important idea, which William James, the other great 19th century psychologist, came to. He talked about noetic quality. He talked about noesis, and that is the sense of certainty. And Yuval and I are both tremendously impressed with a guy called Robert A. Burton, who was head of neurology at Mount Zion, UC San Francisco. And he wrote this amazing book called On Being Certain, Believing You're Right Even When You're Not. And he really has a convincing argument that our sense of certainty, what we believe in, what we're sure of, is emotional. It's not rational. And that therefore one of the, you know, the great transformation that we as human beings need to go through, which is again what you were talking about before, questioning our own motives, questioning our own, you know, why are we helping people with counseling? Is it to make ourselves feel good? You know, the narcissism that you mentioned that is so easy to feel as a counselor in a counseling situation, our sense of certainty and our sense of worth, this is an emotional condition. And by beginning to question that, we can, I think, actually progress further as social creatures and be more useful to one another and more careful. So things like Landmark, I think, ultimately you know, somebody comes out, you know, there are people who come out of Scientology and say, well, look, you know, I was really a really anxious person. I did Scientology and I stopped being anxious. And I would say, that's great. But that's what happened with you. You are the person who achieved that. Don't attribute that to a technique. Don't attribute it to somebody's magical ability. Accept that it happened in that circumstance. And, you know, one of the things that, that I and my friend Christian Jerko would always say, Christian's been working for 40 years with ex-cult members, is whatever good that happened to you did happen to you, and it belongs to you. Don't think that you have to, you know, I've now left the group, so everything about it is bad. All of my experience was awful. That tendency to black and white thinking is cultic of itself. So accept what was good. You know, you may have fought in the foxholes with other soldiers and experienced horrors, but you've come away with tremendous camaraderie with those guys you were in the foxholes with. And that's not a bad thing.
That's what the best therapists, I remember when I was becoming trained as a therapist, the mentors that I had would often say the same thing. And they would say things like, well, you know, when you have a client that is doing well and they're really thankful to you, the client is saying, thank you so much for helping me. And you really did so many great things for me. My mentors would always say, they'd say, well, what I say to that is I didn't do anything. I mean, maybe I had to a small part in your journey, but really it was all you. And I remember when I was younger and an insecure therapist or more insecure therapist, I would say, well, I'm never going to say that because I want someone to believe that I was an amazing therapist that really helped them. I want them to walk away and tell other people about how amazing I am. And that was just me being insecure and wanting that delusion upheld.
I'm being young.
Yeah. And no, the older
I'm
get
62 now, that's all gone for me.
Yeah. And the older I get, the more experience I get, the more confident essentially I am and the more secure I am in my place on this planet. And the less I need that delusion to be upheld, and the more I'm going to tell a client and or a student or a trainee convincingly, or I believe it in my soul that they were the one that did it. I mean, I've learned through experience how to facilitate a conversation or something, or how to set up an environment, shall we say, that allows for them to do the work, the hard work of progressing and developing. But believe me, if I was the one that did it, I would be magical for all my clients. And I am not magical for all my clients. There's only some clients that really transform quickly. And there are other clients that walk away going, I don't know if that therapist was really all that great for me. So obviously it's not me, you know.
I had the privilege of having a session with Margaret Singer, who I believe was an expert witness at both the Patty Hearst and the Charles Manson trials. She was a professor at UC Berkeley and is famous for the work she did with Edgar Schein in the 50s on returning POWs from Korea. And just had, you know, she, by the time I met her, she'd counseled 2,000 former cult members, always free of charge. She would never charge an ex-cult member, which was a rule that I had too. I didn't charge money for talking with people. She wrote a wonderful book, again with Jan Jelalich, who I mentioned earlier, called Cults in Our Midst. But I met Margaret and her husband actually was a Nobel laureate for functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI. He was one of the developers of it, and he was still trying to get paid by the University of California for all the money they'd taken from it, but never mind. But I went and had dinner with them, and they're just the most marvelous people. And I said to Margaret, so look, I've been out of Scientology for 10 years. I've never gone to anybody for any kind of counseling because, frankly, I haven't met anybody that I'd trust. I'm coming back to San Francisco in 6 months' time. Could I sit with you? And she said, yes, of course. And so I spent 3 hours with her. And she, it was so delightful. Her approach was exactly the same as mine. And that is, you sit, you know, at that time, you sit with somebody and you say, well, you know, what's going on with you? And they will tell you what's going on with them. And that might take a little while. But then they'll get to a point where they start repeating, you know, and that's the point where you come in and you've done a bit of active listening, you know, to show that you understand, or to clarify that you do understand what they're saying. And so at the end of an hour or two, you then say to them, well, what do you think you could do about that? And they'll give you, and you must have had this experience, they'll give you about five things they could do about it. Now, one of them, three of the things are crazy. One of them will get them locked up, and the other one might possibly work. And you say, well, I'd try that one if I were you. And Margaret was able to create an environment in which that happened. And in fact, for me, it was quite interesting because I went into the room and I'd not thought about it at all. And she said, what's going on? And I told her the story. I said, when I was 15 years old, I saw Jimi Hendrix at the Isle of Wight, and I saw him 18 days before he died. And it really upset me. You know, I was 15 and this guy died, you know, and he represented something really positive in the world, and it was really wrong. And what the consequence, you know, and then I went on and talked about being harassed by Scientology and all of that horrible stuff. But the consequence was that I actually went away and wrote a novel in which I brought Jimi Hendrix back to life. As a ghost or what have you, which meant that I spent 2 years reading biographies. I read 14 biographies of Jimi Hendrix. I'm into hundreds of different musicians. I'm afraid it's an obsessive thing with me, anywhere from, you know, the polyphony of the Middle Ages through to, you know, Wally Shoup playing free jazz. I'm fascinated. Swing, blues, rock, jazz, polyphony, anything you like, you know, Stravinsky, anything you like. But I focused on Hendrix for 2 years and made him a character. And indeed, after the novel was published, there was a guy who runs a thing called the Jimi Hendrix Management Institute or something, which is this huge museum. It might well be in Seattle, actually, because that's his hometown. And he reviewed my novel, which is called Voodoo Child's Slight Return, after the Hendrix song. And he reviewed the novel and he hated the novel. He thought it was awful. But he said every detail in it about Hendrix's life and the things he said and did, I think is correct. And the things that he might, because my thought was to bring him back as a 60-year-old and have him, you know, say what he'd have thought through from there. So, you know, a simple little experience. This wonderful woman says to me, you know, what's on your mind? And I, you know, immediately pull this thing out from, you know, 30 years before, or 23 years before, I think it would be exactly. And it started a process in me, which was actually a wonderfully therapeutic process. And it's, for me, it's that. I received a letter about 10 years ago. This woman wrote to me, and the letter went, Dear John, you probably won't remember me. And she was right. I had no idea. I don't know who she was. I spent an afternoon with you. And when I met you, my life was in complete turmoil as a consequence of Scientology. And that was the turning point for me. I've had a happy marriage. I have children. I've had a good career. And I attribute this to that moment. But as you say, you're a facilitator. You're somebody who is enabling somebody to choose the path they want to go on, you know, my metaphor in my Hendrix novel is the crossroads, because it's a metaphor in all blues music, you know, that Tommy Johnson, the guitar player, went to the crossroads, gave his guitar to the devil who tuned it. And after that, he could play. It's been misattributed to Robert Johnson ever since, you know, but in fact, the song Crossroads, he sings, went down on his knees and asked the Lord above for mercy. So there's nothing to do with the devil in there. But you get that point that we're always at a crossroads and there's always a choice to take the other road. And if you're a decent counselor, it's almost that you're getting out of the way rather than getting in the way.
So you're saying I'm the devil and I'm tuning people's guitars at the crossroad? Is that what I'm saying?
I think you've understood me profoundly.
Well, my God, John, like everything you say, I just think, I got to ask him about that. I got to ask him about that. There's just too many things, man. But I have already said I had one last question, but I'll have one last question. And it's just kind of about Jimi Hendrix, because, again, as you say, from Seattle and a local hero, we have a statue of him, the Experience Music Project, which was the big music museum downtown Seattle. It's called something different now, but Paul Allen, the Bill Gates, the other Bill Gates guy, he built this museum. Anyway, he loved Jimi Hendrix. He's a guitarist. It's an amazing place to visit, actually. And I've done late night drunk pilgrimages to Jimi Hendrix's grave, just like every other young man in Seattle. What did you think of the biopic that came out 4 years ago-ish? Did you like it?
I've avoided it, actually.
Oh, really? I'd be curious to see what you think. Because, it's him in England is the...
Yeah. I mean, my claim for my novel is that because I have flashbacks, I go back into his life and look at certain things. There's so much that is generally, for some reason, not known about him. For example, that he spent 18 months in the 101st Airborne as a paratrooper. Most people aren't aware of that. And then that to get out of it, he claimed to be gay, because that, which he never told anybody. That came out much later, that he couldn't stand jumping out of airplanes. Then when you listen to those kind of noises that he gets in Machine Gun or Star Spangled Banner, and you think about it, they're the sounds of free fall. And it was said of him that he would hear sounds and he'd say, how can I make the guitar make that sound? So, you have this incredible involvement. But my claim in my novel, and I still say it, is that I describe the actual death of Hendrix and what happened. There's been so much speculation, that the CIA killed him or this happened or that happened. And if you put together the various biographies, the story is actually there. It's just that nobody tells the whole story. But I'm not going to explain it now, because you've now got to go and buy the novel. Voodoo Child Slight Return.
What's it called again? Say it again.
Voodoo Child Slight Return. And it's published under my slightly more full name, which is John Caven Atack.
Atack. And yep. I assume it's on Amazon?
It is indeed.
All right. Well, John, we'll have to have you back on the podcast in another few months or something.
Let's do that.
Many other questions to ask you. Sentence you say, I'm like, ooh, okay. I've been taking notes. I've been like, okay, well, ask him about that. And then you go on, and I'm like, well, we're too far away from that thing, so I can't go way back to that question. So anyway, we'll have to have you back. But I'm sure the listeners have enjoyed hearing you talk about this. And thank you so much for taking the time to come on our humble little podcast here in Seattle.
My pleasure. And let me again plug I'm with the openmindsfoundation.org, and free of charge, you can go and look at our website. If you've got a few dollars you want to spend, my book about open minds is called Opening Minds, The Secret World of Manipulation, Undue Influence, and Brainwashing. And, we're getting good reports from it. I think it would be good to get these ideas into society. We can make the world a slightly better place, I think.
I think so, too. And if your book is anything close to the way you talk, I'm sure it's a fascinating read.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us out there in podcast land. And please take care of yourself and avoid high control or, get help from openminds.org or other therapists that are in the know if you're in a situation like that, because you deserve it.